Case 23, Huainong, neither good nor evil. The case. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiye Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bow, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practice at Huangmei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huangmei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." Wu Men's comment. It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He is like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down. Wu Men's verse. It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So in our chanting service, I was just so appreciating the beauty of our together voice, and of the way the birds were chiming in and chanting with us, and the sunlight on the floor. And the remarkable, boundless field of emptiness of our Sangha. And, I felt, oh goodness, I'm giving a talk in a few moments. And you know, it was funny, it was just a thought floating across this, exquisite vastness. I vanished again into the chanting. Then we got up and we started walking meditation. And it hit me. And I thought, where is the vast field of boundless emptiness now? As my belly is beginning to knot. I am also someone who is afflicted is too strong a word, but I'll use it anyway. Afflicted by a tremor. I have a little tremor, particularly in my left hand. And when I don't get enough sleep, or if I have caffeine, or if I'm even just the tiniest bit anxious, it blossoms, it just comes into full bloom. And so as I walked up to the altar to offer the incense, Jason just so beautifully embodying this form of handing over the incense to me. I mean, it's quite exquisite. I wish you all had the opportunity to receive incense from him. And out goes my trembling hand to take the incense and place it in the ashes. I'm lucky it stood up straight. And I turn and walk back down the aisle to my seat. So in those moments, I might be tempted to think again, where is emptiness? Here the Zen teacher approaches the altar, grounded in the beauty of the universe, pissing his pants before the Dharma talk. Fortunately, it has nothing to do with that. Well, it has everything to do with that. That is emptiness. My trembling hand reaching forth, taking the incense. My weakness as a human being. My sense, oh God, I am so unworthy, I have these trembling hands. Yes, even that. We imagine, you know, if I can just look further than what is arising right now, I can discover emptiness. Samadhi. I can be free from suffering. What if the first noble truth truly is noble? What if our suffering itself truly is a Dharma gate? What if our sense of separateness, our sense of loneliness, our sense that we are not enough, is precisely the Dharma? Look no further than what we are right now. We sit here together in the Zendo. My mouth is moving. Each of us always manifesting the boundless empty field. We get so easily tricked into thinking that it only shows up in one way. And that it probably isn't the way I am. And yet all that is a momentary dance. This incredible thing to watch a shaky hand reach out with incense and offer it to Buddha. I am so unworthy, arising as I make my offering, nothing but a feeling, a thought floating across. And of course, sometimes those senses of self can arise and be so close to us that it is very hard to see anything outside. And that too, truly a manifestation of causes and conditions that extend back through time infinitely. All evil karma ever created by me since of old. Who is this me that created karma since of old? What is this original face? Look no further.
Drop your bucket where ye are.
It's fresh water, folks. It's fresh water. Drink it up. And now, Melissa,
we'll continue.
It's always really interesting to go second. It's an amazing practice of paying very close attention. As the second speaker of our shared Taisho, I can't drift away at all. And yet I find myself listening to Mike drifting in or drifting along with his words. His words, which are just the representation of his presence. That trembling hand reaching out to the steady hand. Whose hand is trembling? Whose hand is steady? Do we really need to make a false discrimination between those two things? As he's pointing out, what if every single manifestation of this human being, this skin bag, as we like to call it, is the thing we're searching for? And as we really fully immerse ourselves in our lives, as we immerse ourselves in our practice, in listening to a talk and working with a koan, as we sink deeply down, we know the truth that Mike is pointing to and that Wu Men is pointing to. In these lovely words, in every case that Wu Men collected, he always wrote a poem to comment on it. When you work on the gateless barrier, the gateless gate with a teacher, you start to realize who Wu Men is. You start to feel his mind wanting to point directly and also wanting to have you find it for yourself. So these poems are beautiful and challenging. Sometimes his style is called blunt because he's just speaking what's obvious. But is it obvious? No, our minds rush in and try to figure it all out. It can't be described, Wu Men says. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. If this is really true, that the Great Way is manifesting everywhere, in our anxiety before giving a talk, in our fumbling, in our hitting the bell just right, in the taste of food, in the sound of the birds and the sound of the traffic. Everything coming forward just as it is, we coming forward just as we are. Well, that actually is good news, and it's really bad news for the mind that loves to condemn ourselves and others, that loves to make up narratives and string everything together so it makes sense. It's bad news because the narrative is it too, and the making sense is it too, and the being effective in the world and the being useless, all of it are it too. How could that be? Where am I supposed to go? And some of you know the line that so many of us love from Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, all of you are perfect just as you are, he once said to his Sangha, and you could use a little improvement. Both of them are true. I'm not who I was when I first started out on this path. I had very strong opinions about who I was, and most of them were really negative. And I've maintained most of them over the last 40 years. You know, you really make me tired and anxious and I'll go right. That's like my default. We all have these narrative defaults. Some of us are lucky enough, I don't know if it's lucky, to have really positive default self-opinions. I'm actually pretty good at being a human being. Just as dangerous, really. Because nothing stays the same. I hope I'm not telling you something brand new, but if I am, take these words in and look. Is there anything that stays the same? Can you really come forward with anything? Well, I think of myself as, I have a photograph that my oldest friend gave me when I turned 50. Many, many years ago. And she and I were, our mothers were pregnant at the same time with us. And so we refer to each other as womb mates. So we've been friends for 64, almost 65 years, and she sent me on my 50th birthday a photograph that she framed. She had blown up from an old little Polaroid of she and I sitting on a sofa when we must have been 3 years old, reading to each other. We couldn't read. And she's looking with great concentration at the book. And I'm looking at her, and it looks like I'm teaching the Dharma. So, Nancy, let me tell you what this means. And like, so I'm still that person, and when I look in the mirror, I think I'm going to see that little girl with her pigtails and her little pinafore. And who is this person in front of me with the sagging skin and well, I won't go on. Is that, where's the original face in this situation? I love a line that I quoted to one of you from a poem by Rumi, where he says, your grief for what you've lost lifts a mirror up to where you're bravely working. You look expecting the worst. Don't we? Always looking. That original face, it must be gorgeous. It must be beautiful. But I don't know, me? Could I be the original face? Monk Ming, so deluded, thinking he knows what he's doing, like most of us. And then suddenly the shocking moment, the hit on the head. We look expecting the worst, and Rumi says, and here is the loving face you've been longing to see. Our first Zen teacher used to have us cover the mirrors in the house where we had our sesshin. So you wouldn't get to see your face for 7 days on a 7-day sesshin. And then it was always really interesting to have those cloths taken away because I never looked the way I imagined. And now in this temple, we don't cover the mirrors, so you get to see yourself all the time in the bathroom. And do you ever meet your eyes? Do you ever see the face there? Do you ever give yourself a little smile and a nod, or do you frown and go, oh, shit, not you again? Or do you just avert your eyes because that's the instruction? Don't make eye contact, even with yourself. We look expecting the worst, and here's the loving face, the loving eyes we've been longing to see. The whole world is offering itself to us. And Wu Men says the original face has nowhere to hide. The secret that's been pointed out to us is an open secret. Nobody's hiding anything. we say the same crap over and over and over. It's not really, it doesn't vary. Sometimes we throw in new stories, new poems, new koans. It's the same stuff. Here it is. Here it is. Here it is. Listen, look, smell, taste, touch, feel how you're being cared for by this original face which beats your heart and makes your blood circulate and works your immune system. If you were in charge of any of this stuff, instant death. Just like Joan Tollefson's beautiful piece about the weather. Did you make this day where the humidity has gone down and the temperature has gone down, we get to open the windows and hear the traffic and the birds instead of the sounds of the fans and the air conditioners? If you did, I would like to talk to you later. Because I have some requests about climate change. And I'm thinking, you're falling down on the job. And then the last line of this poem, which is a real challenge, and once you get to know Wu Men, you know that he's always challenging us in the last line of his poetry. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. In another translation, it is indestructible. Well, you know that's not true. Everything passes. But the original face, the Dharma, it keeps shape-shifting. But it's so reliable, but not as any one thing. Don't buy this without inspecting the goods. Open the box and make sure that the package hasn't cracked. Check it out for yourself. The original face is offering itself to you every single millisecond. And you're missing it only because you think it looks a particular way. It shouldn't be anxiety or trembling. It shouldn't be fear and sadness. It shouldn't be any of the millions and billions and trillions of thoughts that are going through the heads of all the people in this room right now. And yet it's also them. How amazing. It can't be described, it can't be pictured, it can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. Thank you. So you know what to do. We'll take a few moments for people from behind the fireplace to adjust their seats if they'd like. Who's got their hand up?
Justin.
Thank you for a beautiful talk, a really heartfelt demonstration that I really appreciated. The thing that grabbed me is this original face constantly shifting and nowhere to stand, and yet are taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are constantly shifting too. And that just hit me, so thank you.
I've noticed on a bunch of retreats that I've been here, and in the parlor, on one of the bookshelves, there's a little seated Buddha with a little mirror.
A little louder.
With a little round mirror on its lap. Mm. And, you know, I always look at that, you know, and it's always a reminder to me, oh yeah, me too.
I have to say that the irony of that is that that little mirror, we put that there 30-something years ago when our daughter was really little, and it came from something else that was part of a, I don't know, a like a child monitor thing or a bicycle. It just came from something, a toy or an accoutrement, and it just fit right there. So it's kind of cool, right?
There's also a little Buddha with a feather boa there. We call her Broadway Buddha.
And she's the one whose neck was broken and was glued together, and the feather boa put around to make her whole right where she was wounded.
And my friend Nancy crocheted her. Crocheted that boa. All these causes and conditions. Anyway, check her out.
So it's interesting the way that every time you hear a koan, a different line leaps out. And so what leapt out for me this time was the last line of the text, where you know, having given Ming this amazing teaching, right, that changed his life, then he says, oh, don't call me your teacher. Let's both call Wang Mei our teacher. Let's both call Bad Lu Sui our teacher. And so that's kind of interesting, and I know you could say, well, because he knows it's going to be controversial, blah, 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 but I like to think there's something more going on. So it looks like you have an answer.
No, I want to hear your answer, because you get something here.
Well, no, actually, I'm puzzled by it.
Oh, you're puzzled by it.
I'm offering my confusion.
Thank you. So somebody else is going to clarify it.
For me, it brings me back to the robe and the bowl. It's like, you know, that our teacher is the Dharma, and that what we share, which we love, is the Dharma, and that, you know, and so he says we're both students of the way, basically, and what we bow to is the Dharma, not to these symbols.
And I think there's some cautionary tale here too for us teachers and Dharma teachers, senior Dharma teachers. I don't know about the danger of teaching or thinking that we are the teacher. You know, I think what Bob said is so true, that it's like all of practice. If you take it personally, you're in trouble, right? If you take all your thoughts personally, it's pretty difficult. So if you think you're the Tenzo, you're in trouble. But if you're just getting the meals ready, ordering people around, having a good time, no problem. But it's so easy to get stuck in these labels. So some invitation here, about the mutuality. And I guess, so on the form level, you know, I'm sitting up here and you're sitting there, and in the Doksan room I sit here and you come in and sit there, and we play those roles, and that's only one level. The other level is the mutuality of two human beings, two Buddhas meet. Buddha meets Buddha, and you teach me and I teach you. And we have these roles, but also there's no giver and receiver. No one giving something to the other one. There's simply a meeting in the Dharma. And then we both give and receive.
And I never saw this before until this moment. So thank you for pointing it out. I just wanted to check it out. So Huang Mei was actually the name of the place. Mm-hmm. And the teacher's name was Hung Ren. And I don't think I mentioned the teacher's name when I told the story, but so Huang Mei was the monastery, and then he meets Hung Ren and learns this stuff. So what does it mean that let us both call Huang Mei our teacher? Like, let us both call the temple our teacher, the structure of things our teacher, the forms.
That's why I said let's call Boundless Way our teacher.
Thank you, Alan. That's very clarifying. Yeah, because I always heard it as let's call the fifth ancestor our teacher, and this translation isn't saying that, so it's pretty cool. He's away in the back. So.
Thank you for the shared thought. That was that kind of opened this poem in a new way for me. So I kind of saw that if I'm kind of moving through the world as my knowing, then carrying the road is kind of me traveling hand in hand with my experience, however it's unfolding. And the kind of road representing the Dharma of the way things are. And at times I get kind of bum rushed by this means coming to offer some explanation or some idea of the way things should be, or how something could be different, or how I would prefer something to change, and just kind of putting that experience down. Like, look, this is kind of just a moment in our life. Is there anything that really needs to be different? And just kind of putting that road down, and this moment can't pick it up, can't touch it, can't do anything to it or with it. And that was just kind of coming up for me as the talk was unfolding, seeing it, and that's kind of symbolic there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And what I really want to appreciate is this spaciousness that you just described of these things that arise for us, right? Whether they're an experience or a thought or a feeling or whatever it is, a vision, we look out the window or we see something, right? That it's part of a bigger landscape. And sometimes this infinite, boundless landscape that we call the Dharma, right? We call oneness or boundlessness or emptiness. And sometimes and Mike referred to this in his talk, sometimes what arises can be very provocative. And it can do what I call take center stage. It could really get so big that I lose sight of the larger landscape, so to speak. And when you said, with what's just right here, does anything actually need to be different? It was such an inviting question, such an open question. And so thank you so much.
And I think, too, so this koan is about transmission. And all of you have received the transmission. All of you carry the robe and the bowl. The true Dharma is not wearing a brown robe and blabbing more than anyone else. The true Dharma is exactly as you say, right? And then we forget and get taken over. But then we remember again. Oh yes, I remember who the authority is now, right? And he has a beard and hair that goes up, and he's kind of a tall guy. Who could it be? Thank you.
That's okay.
So one thing that's interesting is with Ming is every time he presents himself in a way, like vocally about, like here's what my understanding of it. He gets shot down by Wei Nung, and it's almost like his original face is in between. He harmonizes when he's like present, but not kind of like giving his understanding of it. It's like it's just in between moments where he really seems to kind of have his original face, but not when he's actually kind of like, I'm expressing myself, and here's my ideas of what I think is going on. So it's just a really interesting point in the story.
And Wei Nung exemplifying that by just putting down the robe. What's the true Dharma? He's already laid it down. I'm not going to offer another idea about it. And of course, still we do. We come up and talk about it. So I still think, though, that recognizing, and we've said this before, but recognizing that our maps and whatnot are maps. They are the Dharma too, but they cannot be inclusive. They cannot convey the aliveness of who and what we are. So, you know, we point and use our words. And what a beautiful thing, too. Like, they're worth really appreciating, I think, and valuing. Even our stories, the textures of our feelings and hearts and senses of self, and all, nothing needs to be excluded. But we can get to the, we can get tricked into thinking it's only this thing, right? And then hardening around that or some version. And that's, you know, that's why I, one of the reasons I love Wei Nong is he just puts down the rope. Could I do that? I love how, you know, like, would I do that?
And just to add just a few more words onto that is, you know, how much it strikes me that this character Ming that we have come to know and love so well this week, right? That his true face shining through all the while, even in his doubt. Wow, you've just told me a secret, but really, is there anything more? He says, right? True face can't be hidden. Can't, nowhere for it to hide, right? Always showing our true face. We sometimes think that even that has to be this just this special thing that I show. But all is here.
Well, actually, I think Cheryl, you had your hand up before, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is going to open a can of worms.
Oh, forget it then.
Yeah. Next.
Or maybe not. Maybe. Okay. So what thought came to me was that, you know, this story is really it, there's a lot of potential confrontation here. You know, where the one monk is given the robe and the bowl, and the other one thinks that he shouldn't have it, and so they're going to really go at it, you know. And I'm thinking, I wonder how the story would have been written if they were women and not men. You know, could it possibly have, you know, like, unfolded in the same way, or would they have, like, communicated more beforehand?
Hey,
I'm looking at Laura because we actually had this conversation in the teachers' meeting.
Oh, you got to hear this. Yeah,
and you know, this is big generalizations.
Yeah, yeah.
Not applicable to everyone who identifies as male or female. So I just wanted, that's my caveat, right? But what we said was probably there would have been a lot of crying and kind of passive aggressive attack. You know, junior high school.
And I want to add one more thing onto it, because these images came up for me. And one was, it was actually much more violent than this exchange. It was a real cat fight.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's mine! Like the vision of the what used to be, what used to happen at the old Filene's basement. People found the perfect red top they wanted, you know, and everything. I had it first. And then the other one was no, you take it. You were here first. You have it. You take it. No problem. I'm sorry. They're both so stereotypical.
Yeah.
Of us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And this is what arises, right? And to face those stereotypes, right? We can keep them hidden. We can and fun to laugh about. You know, and also to know that they can be held very deeply, you know, that we don't even know that we're carrying them. We don't even know this, right? And to bring them out into the light and to be able to go, oh. And so there's these two very, you know, funny and yet at the same time so fragile and so vulnerable about, yes, yes. That's me. That can be me. That can be me.
And just to go all out of the realm of stereotypes and, you know, that in what we know of history,
is that there was a lot more stepping back from women who received transmission. And so, you know, the sixth ancestor, right? But there were other women teachers in China who received transmission, but they don't get into the lineage dedication. So we changed our lineage. This happened, those of you who were here last summer, we had a big Dharma dialogue about this, and it prompted Josh to do a lot of research, and he changed the ancestor, which talked to, now called the ancestor dedication. And all these women who said, oh, it's okay, I don't need to be, are now in the lineage dedication. And one of our direct ancestors, James Ford's first teacher, was a woman. But nobody knew that because she changed her name to a Japanese name, Hoen Jiu Kennet. So we decided to put in Peggy to make sure that everybody knew that she was
which
a woman.
Was her English name.
Which is her English name, Peggy Kennet. She was born with that. So there's these ways that we can, you know, that tendency of women to step back, but also of men to push forward. Again, generalizations. But historically, or it's probably not real history, something did happen where men and women, you know, who was the Buddha's Dharma heir?
Mahakashapa,
and then his Dharma heir, Ananda, is famous for convincing the Buddha to let women into the Sangha, saying that, and the Buddha said, yeah, they can be as awake as anybody else, and Dogen said that. But sort of in the mists of history, gender has been, right? And still is.
I'd also just like to highlight that there have been nunneries, you know, where obviously people are practicing seriously, and we just know almost nothing about them. You know, so we hear about them if you read the history books. There was a nunnery at this place found, you know, at such and such a time, and you know, they may glancingly talk about a particular female teacher, but then it just, that's it. It doesn't really make it. So I love that we changed it to the ancestor chant.
That's really cool. Yeah. So Libby?
Yeah, so this is getting at something that's been sort of confusing and upsetting me about this case, which is that Wei Nung, when he hears the Diamond Sutra, right, that's when he, and his response is to leave his mother and to go straight to the monastery and the male teacher who's going to teach him. But Wu Man sees something else in there and talks about Wei Nung in terms of his grandmotherliness.
It turns out what? His grandmotherliness. Feeling the lychee nut?
Oh. Which, from the very first time you read the case to us, I immediately made that connection back to it because you provided that historical or biographical frame
or
for this case.
Mythological.
Right. Biomythological frame for this case. And it made me think of immediately that first time that he left exactly where he was and went off to find the Dharma somewhere else. His mother was giving it to him. She was giving him lychee nuts from the beginning, or peeled lychees, and she was meeting him Buddha to Buddha, as any mother does with her infant, mm-hmm. and her small child, and then her bigger child, and then her older child, and then her adult child. And he couldn't see it.
Right.
And he left her all alone.
I'm just going to stop you for a moment. I love what you're pointing out. This is so great because, for me, it tracks the koan again. You know, the koan appears to me to be about thinking I know what is true and correct and then doing it and then being redirected to, oh, I didn't know that. And we see it in the story of the Buddha who left his wife and stepmother. And then later, they come back and become part of his sangha. You know, so there's this circularity that happens. And in the story, Ming plays the same role. He thinks he knows what he's doing. He's leaving the monastery to get the robe and bowl, and of course that's not, he's wrong. And so Wei Nung also in the beginning is wrong. He leaves what is already, he leaves his true nature to find his true nature.
Mm. And his first teacher.
Yeah, right.
And doesn't know
yeah.
his teacher.
Yeah. Thank you.
So a couple things occur to me around this. One is that this story is often seen as Chinese culture coming to terms with Buddhism. And really, this idea, the illiterate, Buddhism actually is practiced in China, was very intellectual, it was the higher class, especially in the 5th, 6th, 7th century. And this is a movement to incorporate the Taoist sage, the uneducated but the totally brilliant. And one very important part of the story is that he got money to support his mother before he left. Because part of Chinese culture is this filial piety, which with the Chinese did not find in Buddha's story, who Buddha just took off, left everything. So on that level of cultural, how does a culture use its own wisdom? How do we use our own wisdom and honor these stories? And it's always this blending that's happening now. So that's one thing. And then the second is that sometimes we always talk about home leavers. Those of us on the way are home leavers, and there is some way that we do have to leave our home. And this real quandary, how do we honor, you know, your mother and your father? Without them, you would not be here. You should bow down to them, no matter how flawed and terrible. And yet we must leave home, we must leave what is familiar to find what has been ours all along, this true home. So wonderful to point out that, what? Yeah, to name that, so thank you.
I also want to hark back, I think this is wonderful, Louis, and I want to hark back to our chant. The Dharma is rarely encountered, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages. That, and that we find it where we find it. And so we wander and then, boom. You know, how many of us stumbled into some place, talked to some person that sort of drew us down a path we didn't expect to go? And so, you're right, he didn't find it with the mother who was already giving him the lychee nuts. He wandered. And then he found it, you know, threshing rice. Who knew, right? And so we can't know. And in some ways, it's an accident, these paths we take. Happy accidents sometimes.
So how about Wayne first?
Okay. Just to kind of a footnote to this. And I don't know what century this was, but the Ruists, what we call the Confucians and the Taoists, were having some back and forth about you cannot realize your nature except with other people. And they were sort of looking at the Buddhists saying, look what they are doing. This poor mother is left. This guy's going out gathering wood to support her, and then off he goes. He could have stayed there, as you said. He could have stayed right there.
Mm-hmm. If he was a good Confucian, he would have stayed there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. If he was a good Taoist, he would have left.
Yes.
And you might say that Buddhism is really taking these two streams, or Zen anyway, you know, and trying to make a sense of them, an apologia. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they weren't sure about it. They felt like, wait a minute.
Well, and we're not sure about it. Are we? Right? That's
right.
And so the not being sure about it, for me, is one of the hallmarks and root teachings of Zen.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I don't get this. Huh? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
We should have... that's a very important attitude to have. And this story prompts that for us, doesn't it?
Right. And on that note of not knowing... Let's return to our Zazen.